Hey, Collaborist, I'm Ben Leroy.
And I'm Jason Buchholz.
And you are listening to Collaboracast. How's it going, Jay?
I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
Doing all right. We left people last episode with a little bit of a cliffhanger. You were in the middle of a big tsunami warning. How did that all play out?
That made for quite an interesting afternoon. There was quite a big response. There were mandatory evacuation orders being issued. And then about 45 minutes later, we got the word that the tsunami itself was going to be about 30 centimeters high, which is between 11 and 12 inches. So not the destructive event that at one point they were evacuating Berkeley to within a half a mile of the shoreline, telling everybody to get 100 feet up in elevation. Everybody down at my son's high school was panicking because all of their phones started going off with this warning immediately, and they did not have very good information. So people were running out of classrooms, running up to the top floors. I started a text chat group with him and his friends to tell them exactly what was going on. And then not long after that, we got word that it was a big nothing burger, as they say.
But there was a definite adrenaline dump in that window.
Definitely. I was pretty wired the rest of the day, as were many other people. But the evacuation order in Berkeley was not a suggestion. It was sheriffs were going to start going through and making sure that the whole area was cleared out. And quite a dramatic event that turned into nothing with a single announcement that came out of from the National Weather Service. So I'm still here. We are, I'd say high and dry, but we've got a much needed storm that has just moved in. So
on much more mundane stuff, my computer is telling me that it is 4 degrees here. When I woke up, it just said zero. So that's forward progress. And with the wind chill, it was negative 11 this morning. I haven't left the house yet, but that's it. What do we have on today's episode?
Today we are joined by a special guest, Madeline Postman. Madeline was an early client of Collaborists. She has a manuscript called 16 Stories. It is a short story collection that links a memoir with historical fiction based on her family of Chinese and Eastern European Jewish immigrants to California. I've got a little bit of a selfish reason for having her on today. I wanted to talk about her manuscript, but she also has had three different pieces from that collection get published recently in various collections. One piece, Things My Dad Told Me, was just published in the Hope Prize Anthology by Simon & Schuster Australia. The Hope Prize is an international short story prize for stories that are about hope, courage, resilience. The proceeds, I believe her story was shortlisted for that, and she can, when we get her in the studio here, she can correct me on any of these details, but it was shortlisted for the Hope Prize. Currently, the Hope Prize anthology is out, including her story. The proceeds from that go to Australia's mental health charity, which is called Beyond Blue. A second piece called His Bones was recently published in the Oxford Flash Fiction Anthology. And a third piece, Gold Mountain Diggers, was published in Levina Press, which is a literary magazine. And as we talked about last week, I'm working on some nonfiction now, which is kind of a similar format in that they're standalone. They are linked episodes, but any of them could be kind of a standalone story. And I would very much like to have the sort of success with them that she's had. So I've got her here so I can learn about how she went about doing that and get some information for myself. So let's get her in here.
Yeah, let's be done with the chit chat and welcome Madeline. Hi, Madeline.
Hello. So great to be here. It feels unreal.
Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. I like the weather update from today. That was a bit different.
And you're joining us from London. What's the London weather update?
My weather update is it's pitch black right now because it's 6:11 p.m. and it's pretty wintry. So yeah, kind of nice in-season weather, nothing too unexpected.
When you get wintry, do you get the sort of damp cold because of your proximity to water? Is it that sort of uncomfortable, yep, need eight wool sweaters type cold?
Yep, it's always damp, goes right to your bones. Yeah.
That London fog.
Yes.
I've heard is a thing.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you became a writer?
Yes. So I guess my background is kind of here. It's actually the way my book starts, is that I look in the mirror and I see sort of half Chinese from the front and Jewish from the side, potentially. But at the same time, I never really felt that connected with my heritage. In terms of growing up, I didn't feel like I had a very strong Chinese or Jewish background. So I've always wanted to write, and writing about my family brought together, I'd say, four things. Let's see if I can remember them all. One is just really loving writing. I really just love the joy of writing, and that's what sort of keeps me going all the time, in any case with writing, even when you get agent rejections that we'll come to probably a bit later. I wanted to find out more about my family history and just the genealogy of my family. And I've been interested in that for quite a long time, but didn't have the sort of impetus to research more. So I thought that would be cool to learn more about that. Also just history in general. I've always felt a little disconnected from, you know, general history. And I thought that researching my family and what their part is in history could connect me more to that. And also I lost my mother when I was 4 years old to suicide, and talk very little about that, even though I've written about it extensively. And so I thought if I write about my family history, I'll need to write about her at some point, because I can't sort of go back in time, come to the present and not talk about that. So I was sort of forcing myself to write about that as well. So it brought together those four things and sort of a sense of accountability as well, because I just told, you know, everyone I know about it, started writing beginning of 2017. And then I think we have a lot more stories. I don't want to just sort of talk nonstop because we'll probably get onto other subjects, but in terms of how that came together or didn't come together, and how I found my way to you guys as well as part of the whole story too.
Could you talk a little bit about the structure of your manuscript? So 16 stories is, not surprisingly, 16 stories, but yes. Your choice for the point of view I found to be really interesting. Could you talk a bit about how you went about doing that and how you were able or not able to kind of inhabit fact and history, and where you had to imagine things and what that process was like for you?
Yes. So in terms of structure, when I started, I have a document called Structure, and it's basically the table of contents of the book. And I thought, oh, that's my structure. And I think that was before I'd really written much and understood narrative arc and the character's journey from A to B and the change and the structure in the sense of, is it a three-act structure? What's the conflict? What's the motivation? What is, you know, that mix of the characters and the setting and the facts? Because when you write historical narrative nonfiction or fiction, you've done a ton of research, and you know, part of the author, part of me, I just wanted to show off my research. It's like, you know, you find out about the gefilte fish line, which is where the Jewish dish of gefilte fish, on one geographic side of the line, it's salty, and on the other side, it's sweet. So it's like, that's such a cool fact. I need to make that work in my story, you know, even if it, you know, it doesn't really matter to your character, the setting, and you know, it's just like showing off your knowledge. So I think there was a lot of that happening in my first draft. And so 16 Stories has become something else. It's now called Staring into the Sun, because I started to rewrite it after our manuscript assessment. I did some rewriting. I started submitting to agents. It wasn't really working. So I started reworking the whole thing and making sure that each chapter could be a standalone story. And I just rewrote it in a sort of organic way rather than following the chapter order that I had initially, which starts in the present, goes back to the past, and finishes in the present again. I just wrote how it came to me. So linking, so I started with the same chapter, but then I just linked in terms of the character that was speaking to me the most that I wanted to go on to next. Because originally the 16 stories were my brother and myself, our parents, our grandparents, and our great-grandparents. That makes 16 right. people.
So each of the chapters was from a different family member or ancestor's point of view. Is yes. that no longer the case?
It's still the case, but going along sort of organically, then I got to 9 and I thought, this really works well by itself. It's complete. The thing is, it was only half my family. I know that half of 16 isn't 9, but trust me on it. It's basically my brother and myself that makes the sort of odd number. And so I left out my dad's side of the family. It only deals with the Chinese side of my family, the way that the short story collection is now and the way that I am submitting to agents now. But it is still, it's still, each chapter focuses on a certain person. But now the people who I knew are memoir written in first person from my point of view. So those are, I think it's 4 chapters. And then there are 5, which are essentially something between narrative nonfiction and historical fiction, because I don't know where that line is. And I think it's more of a hybrid, which is another challenge in terms of like, what is this thing, this, you know, beast, this Frankenstein that I've made.
Interesting. So what are you calling it in your queries?
So I'm calling it a short story.
Go ahead. Sorry.
So I'm calling it a short story collection, and on Query Tracker, where you can find agents and they've got different genres, I'm querying agents who accept short story collections, which are always classified under fiction, under the Query Tracker categories. And then also the agents who accept memoir, which is categorized under nonfiction. So if they're open to both of those, I don't think there's a hybrid category in Query Tracker, but also when I read the manuscript wish lists, if the agent says, I'm interested in hybrid, or I'm interested in intergenerational family stories, things like that, then I think, oh, they'll be, you know, open to this.
So it just kind of depends on what the agent's looking for. Then it sounds like it kind of straddles both genres pretty clearly.
Yes. Yeah, and if they're not interested, some agents say, I'm not interested in memoir, or I have too much memoir on my list, or it's hard to sell, whatever, then I won't query them.
Fine, it's a short story collection.
Yeah, I just don't query them, because it's all, I don't want to pretend like it's not memoir, you know, those particular chapters.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So did I get it right about the various publications? And was that the 3 that have all kind of, that's all been within the last few months, right?
Yeah, it was, yeah, you got it completely right in terms of the shortlisting and all of that. The really weird thing was that after writing for pretty like almost 8 years, everything got printed pretty much in the same week in mid-October, which is also my mother's birthday. So, and they were being printed in Australia, the US, and the UK. And 2 of the stories are stories from the 9 in the short story collection. And then 1 is a piece of flash fiction with some speculative elements, the His Bones piece, but it's actually based on my family history as well. So it was all family history, and it all just came together in that week, which was.
Okay. So that one is not in the larger manuscript.
No.
Can I ask what it's been like exploring writing at the same time that you are exploring new to you family history and the understanding of genealogy, and if there is any temptation or unintentional machinery where the people who lived real lives, your family members, are also characters in what you're writing? And in the case of grandparents and other generations that you might not have had as much time with, what it's like to sort of understand the world as they saw it?
I just think it's all so fascinating. It's a bit of a, the research is like being a detective, and it's like being tenacious, like being a dog with a bone to try to uncover this information. And then every so often you get a jackpot. Like I started out with my dad's grandfather, who died before my dad's father was born. So he died when his wife was pregnant. And that was in Poland. And going into this, we thought that that was the person we knew nothing about. So in 2017, I asked a genealogist to do some research on him. And she found so much information. She found all these cousins, like his brothers who had emigrated to New York. So I'm in touch now with, like, on an almost daily basis with my distant cousins from that line who were called Postman, which is a, you know, pretty unusual last name. And the Postman name goes back like to the mid 1800s. I've met one of those cousins in person. She was over here in London. Nikki, hi. She's in Santa Cruz. And in terms, so there's this like Mission Impossible way to find those records. So there was, I found an article in a genealogy magazine for Jewish genealogy, and it shows how you look up the book of residence on a Polish website. So it's in Polish. You're going through these links, like you go like three or four links deep, and then you suddenly come up with a list of numbered JPEGs that correspond to a spreadsheet that you've downloaded. So it just take like, it's like computer science to find the image. And then suddenly you might find an image or in the spreadsheet, some information that volunteers have translated. So I remember being in front of my computer looking at this spreadsheet like late at night, and suddenly there's my great grandfather, Zygmunt Postman, and his date of death and his, that he died in Włocławek, northwest of Warsaw, which is where he was from. So he'd been serving in the Russian army in Odessa, and then he went home to die. So I don't know how, what he died from, but in my book, I think, oh, maybe he died of tuberculosis, because he was like, that would be kind of like a likely reason to be sick and to go home to die. I mean, he could have died in an accident. He could have gone home because his wife was expecting. I don't know, but just to see that fact come up on a spreadsheet, and then, like, you know, I cried because I was like, oh my gosh, he's there, like on this spreadsheet. I love spreadsheets anyway. But yeah, so finding that fact. So that doesn't really get into your question of the, you were sort of asking about finding the family history and their character.
Yeah,
and...
but what I was most curious about was the emotional roller coaster that that is. And so being able to see a JPEG of somebody who is like critical in you being here, without that person, you're not here. But they're also a ghost in that we don't have any contact with them. They're kind of faint in the memory and whatever inherited DNA we have. But that seeing people, and I've been on a not dissimilar genealogy journey the last couple of years, where I just start learning these details. It's like, oh, these people all had real lives, like full lives, and did things and got up every morning and went to bed every night and everything in between. Yeah. And there's, for me, there's been like a pretty profound emotional connection when you realize, when they go from being abstract to anything more real, and you are even taking it a step further by writing about them and from their perspective. And that feels like, what a way of honoring people. And at the same time, the amount of searching about self-identity that comes with that has got to be, it's got to be a charged experience.
Yeah, there's definitely the honoring as well, and kind of completing a circle, which is what the flash piece, His Bones, is about. There's, Chinese people, maybe other Asian cultures, I don't know, they would, so the immigrants who would die in America, there were benevolent societies that would go across America and dig up these bones after 5 or 10 years and then ship their bones back to China so they could be buried in their homeland, so their souls would be at rest. And my great-grandfather, who was born in southern China, who emigrated to the US, he's buried in a crypt in Oakland, pretty close to you, Jason. And so his bones never returned to China. And the flash piece is about how we found there was a painting of him. There are these different sorts of remnants of his life left behind. And I organized for these to be shipped to the Zhongshan Museum, which is near his village is near the city of Zhongshan. So now these paintings are in that museum. And so it's, you know, his spirit's been returned to his homeland. So there's definitely a vein of honoring ancestors and sort of completing circles. And also like honoring the sort of mundane quotidian facts of our life. You know, you don't have the Chinese side of my family is super interesting. There's like a millionaire and a magician and a fashion designer. And so they are more in a way like appealing to write about. But I love the sort of more like just mundane facts of people's lives as well that affected more people, not just the millionaires.
I was going to ask what it was like to in that revision process to decide to leave your dad's family to basically trim that out. And do you have other plans for writing about them in a different context or?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it felt, I guess on one hand, like a bit of a disservice, and I kind of wanted his blessing for it. And he essentially, you know, he says like, oh, I can see how, you know, the Chinese side of your family is more interesting. But I do have plans, and it's, my plan is in my first full novel, because the short story collection is now 46,000 words, and a typical debut novel is like 80 to 90,000 around that range. And so I do have a storyline, which is a dual timeline around the 1900s in between Poland and emigrating to the US, and then a sort of near future timeline, probably in London. It's based on a short story that I wrote, and it has to do with AI data doubles and sort of exploring questions of identity, what happens to us after we die, people remembering you after you die. And it might be a kind of thriller thing with like some intrigue between, and there obviously has to be a tie between the 1900s timeline and the near future timeline. And I don't quite have the details of the hook yet, but that's the plan for the first full book, which will be fiction.
That sounds pretty fascinating. Are you thinking of that as kind of science fiction or more just that's where we are in real life? So not so much science fiction-y, but just contemporary fiction.
Yeah, it'll be like a near future, like a plausible near future, like a 2035, because if I write it now, it has to be 2035 at least, because otherwise it'll be published before it's, you know, the time arrives. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it'll be like a plausible near future, because data AI avatars exist already. You can get them for, you know, $100 or something in China. So, yeah.
Interesting. It'll be interesting things to explore. Mm-hmm. And what, you know, you talked about closing circles and you're talking about shipping the spirits back and, but also what a gift for your existing family for, you know, you posted a photo of your daughter reading the anthology, like reading about her own family in there you know, what a, through the research and the writing and the different ways that they're appearing in print and manifesting through these different ideas, it's just such a treasure to leave for her, for your family, for your brother, for everybody who also cares about these people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they definitely appreciate it. They're very supportive as well. And my daughter in particular has asked for a copy, like every copy I have of anything, she needs to have her own copy as well. My older child appears as well in the stories, and it's just, yeah, it's great to be able to, like their names are in print too, which is pretty exciting.
Right on. Yeah. What was it like did you have to do a lot of work to adapt them to be standalone pieces? Or, I mean, I'm thinking it's been almost 2 years now since I read the original manuscript. So I'm sure a lot, just in talking to you, I can hear a lot has evolved. But I'm curious about the process of getting these pieces ready for submission, and if mm-hmm. how much you had to change them in order to make them standalone pieces, take them kind of out of that context of the collection. What was that process like?
So I did a short story writing course at a place called City Lit in London, but the course was online. So I did that autumn of last year, so about a year ago. And so that helped workshop some of the stories. I've had beta readers since spring of last year or this year, I can't remember now. Beta readers for a little while, and then got some more beta readers through the short story course. So right now I've got three in particular who are always available to read stories, which is so grateful to them, because it's been the story that was shortlisted for the Hope Prize. I mean, that's been in the making since it was the first story. So it's been in the making since 2017, pretty much. And it started with like that great grandfather and the genealogical research. And it was initially the version that you read. It was sort of introducing the whole, all 16 characters. And so in the process, I've whittled down a lot of characters, because I had every cousin and second cousin of everybody and their friends. And like, it's just like ridiculous, basically. So I've taken out a lot of characters. There's a book, lots of different courses and webinars as well. So I'd say a couple things are really helpful. There's a book called Story Genius. I hope I'm remembering that the right way. And it's, you use scene cards in that for scenes. So I've used those kinds of scene cards together with a basic, like A to B, like is it hopeless to hopeful? Is it disconnected to connected? Is it happy to sad? Like just a really basic, what's the A to B arc? And I heard that mm-hmm. on a webinar from Writers HQ, which is another online community. And so on the scene card, I'll have, what's the basic A to B that's happening? Is there like a lesson I want to teach? Like what will readers come away with after they read the story? And then is there like a motif in it? So in one, it was like toys and puppets was the kind of motif of one of them, of being not really being in control. And then in each scene, there's what happens in the plot, and then how does that it's sort of like what's the character's journey? And then the plot is essentially serving the character's journey. So what happens in the plot and what does that mean plot-wise is kind of like the above what you can see. And then in terms of the character, what does that mean for the character? What are the sort of ramifications of that change in the plot for the character? So I rewrote all of the chapters using the scene cards to try to give point to each of the scenes within the story, and then to give that overall arc for each story too. And then the readers would read them as standalone pieces. That was sort of the process.
Did you experience any kind of conflict between, so that sounds like a very thorough process for creating a standalone story that's self-contained, that's fully, that does all the things that we want short stories to do.
Yeah.
In a linked collection, so you talked about kind of the overall collection and having an overall arc through that. So it isn't just, some short story collections they're not linked. They're just completely standalone, and you can read them out of order. You can read one, you can read three, you can read all of them. In your case though, I'm assuming, let me know if I'm wrong, but it sounds like they're all in a deliberate order, so that there's an arc that goes, an overarching storyline that goes through them all. Did you experience any kind of difficult challenges in writing or any conflict between needing to make them self-contained, but then also needing to make them serve their purposes within that overarching context?
I think they build on each other, so you could read them independently, but you'll have more insight if you read more than one. So you'll, because one, so for example, Gold Mountain Diggers, which is in Levina Press, that focuses on my grandfather, my mother's father, and I see that's kind of like the crux of not the crux of the whole collection, but it's this, the story is that my great grandfather, who emigrated from China, became founded a chain of stores called the National Dollar Stores that you know about, and became one of the first Chinese American millionaires. For some reason, he just completely spoiled his son, his two daughters. He, you know, they brought up, they learned Cantonese and they studied in China. They both have university educations. And but for some reason, the son, who you would think he's going to be the one who's going to take over the stores, he was just always like completely spoiled. And so basically, when he grew up, he was sort of a philanderer. He wasn't a good father figure. So my mother grew up without a father figure. And between, you know, the wealth, the lack of father figure, and then she had her own mental health difficulties. And, you know, and she took her own life. And for me, it's like there's this line of the very wealthy person spoiled his son. The son is kind of an eternal kid, lack of father figure, my mother, and then she died. So like that's why it's such a crucial story. And in Gold Mountain Diggers, like, it's a visit to him that takes place on one day where I'm in my early 20s, and I go visit him at his house in Beverly Hills. And so there's like this mix of, he was a really sweet guy. I mean, he was like a kid. Like, he loved making root beer floats, and he's like, oh, let's make root beer floats, it'd be great. You know, I never make them for myself. And then we go out to dinner, and he's hitting on this waitress, and she's like very cold to him. And then he has a trick where he, because she's cold, he puts he puts a penny and a full glass of water, puts a plate on top, tips it over. So for her to get her one penny tip, she has to like open up the water and we get all wet. So plays this trick. So it's just this shift. So the shift in that story is me seeing him for what he is. And then I kind of explain within that story about my mother and in this kind of chain of events, the way that I see it. And so it ends actually with the last time I saw him in the year 2000. So it would have been 5 years. So that story took place in 95. And then I saw him in 2000. And at the end of it, I just say, you know, I'm not going to see him as a victim of gold diggers or a philanderer or a spoiled kid. I'll just see him for somebody who wanted to be loved. And so like coming to that, that conclusion. So that's one story that has a lot in it. But you could read it on its own, or you could read about more about me and how the first story about kind of coming to terms more with my mother's death and telling my kids about her death. Or you could read about my grandmother, you know, his first wife and what her life was like. And then she's seen from a couple of different points of view when I visit her, or in my mother's chapter where she's seen more as somebody who's more vain, who's had plastic surgery, who's a socialite. So it's kind of like you get the different points of view, and it enriches the understanding of the different people or the different characters. So I'd say that's how they sort of interact in terms of the stories.
I would imagine that for you to be writing about such a personally powerful topic, it must have been really transformative for you. You know, and you talk about that arc of learning about your grandfather and what made him tick and how your perspective of him changed along the way. In kind of the broader picture of the project, like, how much of that was true for you as you were learning about your family? I mean, you talked about now having written about your mom a lot, but did this, it sounds to me, and I'm speculating, that writing kind of around about all these people around her might have helped you kind of close in and be able to really look at that story and write about it. And I'm wondering what that process was like for you. If you I imagine you might have learned a lot along the way, or did you just kind of know things and it was a matter of organizing them? And how did you yourself change as you were writing about that, you know, such a difficult topic?
So that's where the Staring into the Sun title comes from, because that was the title of her chapter. But it is this thing that it's kind of, you know, you're not supposed to stare into the sun, and it hurts. So I think that's where that all comes from. So it's difficult, but it's kind of something that I forced myself to do. I haven't ever been in therapy, which is probably not a good thing. And people say, oh, you shouldn't, you know, writing isn't therapy, you shouldn't use writing for therapy. But like, it was very therapeutic. And I, you know, I still haven't talked about her very much because I've only written about her. And if people ask me about my book, I will very rarely talk about her death, basically. And then, I mean, in terms of the personal journey, I think it's, you know, part of it is bringing just the act of writing about it, bringing it to light, talking about suicide. And there's a huge stigma around suicide and mental health, and that's being talked about so much more. She died in the 70s, and it's such a different world then. And it's also why it's so fitting that it is part of the Hope Prize anthology. So it's called Tomorrow There Will Be Sun is the title of the anthology. Just a coincidence that there's sun in both of the titles. And I love that the royalties are going to Beyond Blue, a mental health charity as well. Because it's, yeah, I mean, I think that any kind of talking about people's difficulties, helplines, any of that is, it can only help to talk about it and bring it out in the open. So it's kind of almost like a bigger movement. And there, you know, there's definitely been a personal journey as well. And it adds to that kind of tenacity in my work.
Do you have any thoughts, getting back to the idea of like writing is not therapy, but you experienced a therapeutic process, and do you have any thoughts, any words of wisdom that you would give other people who find themselves in a similar position where they are going to be confronting some things that they can't possibly know ahead of time, but that will probably be pretty raw? Was there anything you did during your writing process specifically with that in mind? Not necessarily even to protect yourself from whatever hurt might pop up, but just awareness. Is there anything that you did or anything that you learned that you could share with others about that specific issue?
I think, I mean, you used the word aware. I think being aware and acknowledging what you're doing, and I think any creative process can be very like cathartic, healing, you know, whatever it is, and sort of just acknowledging that that's what you're doing. Because I remember writing the first draft of the chapter that is focuses on my mother, and it's written in the second person. It's very in your face. And I remember thinking, oh, this is going to be difficult. And then when I was revising it, I just hadn't given myself that space and acknowledged that I was revising this really difficult chapter. And I remember after that, and I was sort of reading memoirs and like reading pretty heavy stuff as well, you know, in terms of my reading list, and just feeling horrible. And I wanted to like throw the whole, I was going to sign up for a write your novel course and like basically throw out the whole book and rewrite it as some kind of fiction and, you know, just start again basically. And then it was like, wait a minute, I've just been revising this chapter. And that's why, it's like if you're standing out in a storm and you don't even realize it, and you're getting all wet and you're like, why am I all wet? It's like, oh, because it's like there's a thunderstorm out. And it's just sort of, yeah, giving yourself the time and space, letting yourself be upset, letting yourself feel horrible, whatever it has to be, but just not sort of thinking, oh, I've, you know, I wrote for my 3 hours this morning, time to move on to my day job and you're just going to like turn your emotions off like that. But it's like sitting with your emotions and letting them, like feeling bad if you have to feel bad.
Well, I'm really glad you persevered with that. It seems like, yeah, with these difficult things, it's easy to see the temptation of finding easier ways to do it and fictionalizing things and building some distance into that so that we don't have to go through these raw emotions and experiences. Did the process of going through all that, did that change your relationship with your mom or with your understanding of the decisions that she made?
I think it's the honoring it is part of it. Another major thing actually was talking with people. So it was set up as interviews. So again, it's kind of putting this structure into place. Like we're going to do this interview and, you know, I took notes the same way I would do with a call with a client for my sustainability consulting, you know, like this very structured way and putting it a bit at arm's length to protect myself. But I found out so much by speaking with my dad, with my brother, with my stepmother, so many people, a second cousin, my mother's best friend, you know, all these people, and I connect, it was amazing. You know, I mentioned my distant postman cousins. There have been so many people from both sides that I've made connections with, but particularly through finding out more about, for example, part of the relationship between my mother and her father, it wasn't just that he wasn't a father figure, it's that she was really distraught and worried about him being taken advantage of by these gold diggers. And so, you know, that weighed on her really heavily. She had money problems because she had a couple of failed businesses and she probably felt, pressured to be a success like her grandfather was. Her friend told me that she just didn't have a great sense of money, as you know, you might not if you grow up really wealthy. And so it was sort of like putting together some of those pieces. And even it's interesting in some of the, I think it was in the Beyond Blue communications I've seen, it says, you know, people might consider suicide. It might not come from a mental health problem. It might be because you have financial problems or, you know, it doesn't always have to come from depression, for example. So it was getting sort of insights in that way, you know, definitely helped with my understanding of her.
Probably your grieving process too, I would imagine, which is open-ended.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And that's sort of the key. So in the story called Things My Dad Told Me, it's when he said the pain never goes away and you sort of learn to live with it. And it's not the five stages of grief. Like I'm not a big fan of the five stages of grief as a concept because you just feel like it's linear and it's not at all, you know, just, it can come up, any stage can come up at any time. And I think if you don't expect to go through the stages or for the pain to go away, then you can, like you have to learn how to live with it and to, I mean, maybe embrace is a bit too strong, but sort of accept what comes up.
Yeah, it just becomes a part of life, a part of your of who you are and the story of your family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you are out on submission now with the full collection, trying to find a home for it?
Yes. Yes. I've submitted to about a dozen literary agents on both sides of the pond. And the ones who there's a some kind of connection or referral to are the ones who have responded so far. I've had a couple of rejections from cold submissions as well. And then just had a rejection yesterday from somebody who had the full manuscript, which of course was really hard. And then you go, oh, my writing sucks, you know? So you just get that complete roller coaster, you know?
It's the least fun part of writing is when, you know, it's because it's so exciting when you get to that point where you go out on submission and then you remember that people are going to respond and not every single person's going to want it. And it's a brutal part of the process.
Yeah. And then you go on submission to publishing houses, right?
Yeah. Well, you, right. Yeah, that too. But you, with the, your publication successes recently, I'm assuming that, did you start submitting before those publications, before you were accepted and started getting prizes and anthologies and all those things? I'm sure that's part of your submission process now, but that would seem to be very attractive to an agent.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. I started submitting on November 1st. And the Hope Prize was announced in June, and then the others were after that. So I'd say that the Hope Prize in particular has just been a game changer in terms of the profile and the sort of confirmation that my writing doesn't suck is helpful. And it's Simon & Schuster Australia. So there's like a lot of credibility that comes from that. And I think, definitely makes me more tantalizing as an author. And I think it's great to write short stories because you can submit to so many places, contests and magazines. And so it's a great form to write in to get like a leg up on the writing career.
Yeah. And so I am finding myself at a juncture where that's a possibility for me for the first time. I've only ever written novels, and now I'm writing this memoir, but each of these chapters is really kind of, it isn't this happened and then that made this happen and then that made this happen. It's kind of more thematic the way it's divided up. And so I'm interested in kind of pursuing some of the same. I think there's going to be a little more work for me to adapt them to be standalone pieces because it is an overall narrative. But I think that some of them lend themselves to that. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be trying to follow in your footsteps and trying to get those to be standalone pieces. And it sounds like there are a lot of different outlets for that. I'm going to be giving that a try.
Yeah.
You had mentioned also that you were talking about AI earlier, and you had mentioned in our email exchange. I think that it is a topic that a lot of us writers recoil from. Mm-hmm. But you have used it to some success in your process. Would you give me a new perspective on AI as a writer?
Yeah. So I wouldn't use it to write directly, but for example, looking for comps for comparative titles is amazing because you can put in, so I don't really use ChatGPT much. I use perplexity.ai, which I use Perplexity. I don't use it that much, but you can put in a description of the comparative title you're looking for, or a description of your piece and say, give me, five comparative titles. So, because when you query, it's good to have a couple of comparative titles that your book would be shelved on those. I know that you know all this. I'm just saying this for the listeners. Sure, yeah. Your book would be shelved on, on the same shelf as those books. So, which has been tricky with this short story collection. So it can like spit out a bunch of titles for you, which is really helpful. Or even like, ideas for the, how does my narrative in Poland weave in with the near future in London, like some ideas around that. And so I think it's good for like that idea generation, comparative titles. I'm sure it's good for tons of other stuff as well. But those are just a couple of examples in terms of, how I would use it in the writing process.
Have you discovered books or authors that you're really glad to know about? So you mentioned the comps, things that are really relevant, things that have helped you to learn more about your own writing and what may or may not work and how to go about things.
Yeah, I mean, Jhumpa Lahiri's Interpreter of Maladies. Mm-hmm. I think that came up. So it was a 1999 Pulitzer Prize winner. I think that came up through an AI response. Jenny Jang's Sour Heart as well. Much voicier than my work, but it's a great, it's a great, so it's not really a comp for me, but I'm glad to be reading it. I'm sure in terms of my like TBR, the to be read list, it's contributed to that, to those titles. Yeah.
Well, good to know. Yeah, I think it's a long way off from being able to contribute meaningfully to any kind of, I mean, at least for audiences who really care about literature. I'm sure that there are people using it to just crank things out because they want to publish a book and have their name and say that they're an author. But for people who actually engage in serious reading and read it for the art form that it is.
Yeah.
Ben and I have seen a couple of things that were produced by AI, and it's just, it's just knowing when to use it and what for.
Yeah. Changing the tense. That's very good. Past to present, present to past. You know, if you want to, like, what would this be like in the present tense? That's really helpful.
Oh, little tweaks like that. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah.
Yeah, just stuff that is, when you go into robot brain, then AI can do that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It was a wonderful conversation. Congratulations on all the recent success. And we've got our fingers crossed for a full publication for the collection. And it sounds really intriguing. I'm really looking forward to revisiting it when the time is right. It sounds like it's evolved a lot since the manuscript that I first saw a couple of years ago now.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I mean, we didn't really talk much about the manuscript assessment process. I mean, that was really helpful. Again, for you were, you were the first person to read it, actually. So that, you know, just having that sort of, again, confirmation that my writing doesn't suck, which is
the main thing. It does not. It was a beautiful work. And yeah, just very interesting concept and a really just inspirational way to examine these things. And looking forward to seeing how things develop.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I'd love to hear about, I know that you have a new deal as well, and then hearing about this next work in progress. I'll be watching, keeping an eye on that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Lots happening.
Yep.
All right, Jay, what do you say?
For story.
For community. Collabber Madeline Postman, thank you for joining us.